The name's Bond. James Bond.
No, that was pretty bad, guys. Welcome to the show. This is Action Movie Anatomy here on the Popcorn Talk Network. We're going to talk about some James Bond today. And I can't wait to talk about GoldenEye with you guys. We'll see you in just a second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! I mean, boom.
I mean, boom. I'm Bond, James Bond. What did you say? What is it? What was the old line you used to say?
Which one?
From the like the sound check or whatever you do? You used to... Raymond Colicci. You'd always do it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You're talking about the old the Dire Straits one?
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a go at the singles. A song about a jazz band. This song is called The Sultans of Swing.
The Sultans of Swing, and I'm also James Bond. If anybody is still there, I promise you we have better impersonations of James Bond than that.
My impersonation was fine, thank you. Welcome to the show. It's Action Movie Anatomy here on a Wednesday afternoon. We're here to talk to you guys about awesome action movies. And today is no exception, as we're talking about the James Bond film that made our childhood. Like, when I grew up, to me, this was the guy. This was James Bond. There was nobody else. I had never seen an old James Bond movie.
Yeah, I mean, this was exactly what you wanted Bond to look, sound, and act like in the 90s. And for us growing up, this was the coolest dude in the entire world. Like, watching him in Mrs. Doubtfire was, like, offensive after this had come out. Because you're like, that's James Bond. You can't treat him like that. You can't throw apples at James Bond.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It was ridiculous.
It was ridiculous.
He'd shoot you.
Or it was a run by fruiting.
He'd probably have sex with you and then shoot you.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what you did back in the night. Okay, so full disclosure.
And that's all Brosnan does in this movie.
Hey, everybody. It's Wednesday.
Welcome to the show. We're going to talk about GoldenEye because it hits the four basic rules of action movie anatomy here on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking movies, pop culture, and doing it by the bucketful. Rule number one of our show, the hero always plays by their own rules. Of course, James Bond.
James Bond is the definition of a guy that plays by his own rules.
Always.
I like your suit.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. That's right. We're in bow ties.
We are.
Yeah, nice. I like your suit, too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was waiting for you to say it all morning, and I figured I'd just throw the compliment out first.
Yeah, that's cool.
Good. Let's go on to the second rule, then.
Great. Rule number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people, beings, things, dinosaurs, cars, whatever in the room.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, he's real smart, and Trevelyan is his equal.
He's evil, Yanis.
Yeah, Yanis.
Like you set the bombs for 3 minutes instead of six.
Yeah. Oh, that was pretty good.
It's good.
Are you an actor?
No.
Yeah. Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, or political figure. Well, he's a secret agent. He works for the government.
MI6.
He works for an old dinosaur government who's just still running out the same... and then
Judy Dench would not approve.
No, she wouldn't. Rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. Yeah, there's a bunch. James Bond movie. It's always explosions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the definition of a show that fits... a movie that fits our show. It's so interesting, though, because... unfortunately, this is another one of those movies that's kind of suffered from time.
Well... I think what we're learning is that the further we get from movies made in the 90s, the more ridiculous the action-based ones are. And it's based on a lot of different things. This movie in particular, and we'll talk about this all throughout the episode, but this movie in particular is so rooted in that, like, ridiculous, chauvinistic, incredibly sexist, misogynistic culture that
we
the
could
90s
even do a quick
by.
Run. Maybe we'll do that in a minute of like things in 90s movies, like being impervious to an obscene amount of bullets. And like, you know, like there's these things that happen throughout it. And like he like hitting a woman like blatantly before she's attacking you is kind of like it's just like kind of a little uncomfortable. You know, you said you watched it with your girlfriend and like.
Yeah. There was a lot in this movie that was just like, I kind of didn't know what to make of it by the end of it.
Yeah.
By the end of it, I was just sort of like, I looked over at the end and I was like, you know, Casino Royale is a really good movie. Like, it's a cool movie. It's got a good plot and it's like, it has stakes. This just felt like kind of a dumb cartoon in the end.
Yeah. I mean, like, to reference what I was thinking about earlier, it's kind of like your racist uncle at like Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
It's
right.
Like, you kind of like, he's your uncle and you kind of love him.
And Thanksgiving's like, fun. And Thanksgiving's fun. The memories were great.
But you're like, the things that he said throughout dinner were kind of offensive.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know? Just like horrible. Yeah. So, anyway, guys, that's what we're going to break down today. On the show today, we are going to talk about Oversieged, Undersieged, or Properly Sieged, Sean Bean. We're going to talk about our fist bump moments, our favorite lines, who is your favorite James Bond of all time, and other things of that nature. So let's get straight into the episode. But before we do, let's talk social, because I forgot to do it. Can find us each at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram, or AMA Podcast for the Twitter's podcast.
You guys can find me on MySpace.
And you can find Andrew, not on the show anymore.
You can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter. And you can also find the Facebook fan page. You can do the Action Movie Anatomy fan page on Facebook. We've over 1,000 members now.
Yeah.
And then there's also the Action Army fan group, which is more dedicated to our Schmodown personalities. But that's also getting close to 800. But I do have to say this. I know we shout out a lot of our members often, and that's one of my favorite things to do on this show. So I know that it was Sarah Hussein's birthday this last few days.
Happy
birthday,
Sarah.
And she's a huge admin, and she does a lot of work for us. But I want to personally shout out Irina.
Yep.
And the reason for that is because she has gone above and beyond every single week in making these great master posts, even last week when we didn't have a show.
Yeah.
And it's posts that involve conversation. She always brings up an old episode. She's doing our job for us.
She's sharing the old episodes.
Yeah. So, Irina, thank you so much. You have no idea how much that means to us.
You'd think that it would be an easy thing for us to do, but it's not. We don't. So thank you so much, because you're doing the thing that Andrew and I talk about doing all the time, and you're making it just fun and interactive, and we love you guys. And Irina, thank you so much for that.
So let's jump into the trailer here.
Yes.
Which some people are saying this is one of their favorite trailers.
Oh, it's great for the first minute 40.
When the world is the target.
Yeah,
the
72 hours ago, a secret weapon system was detonated over 7 hours.
Yeah, I noticed that right away.
Yeah.
And the threat is real. In a race for the world's most advanced science technology,
she's as ruthless as she is cunning. It would take two scientists.
You can still depend on one man.
I want you to find Goldeneye.
Three.
Find who took it.
Two.
And stop it.
One.
And this is 6 years since the last Bond movie. So when you saw this trailer in a theater, you were like,
like, oh my God.
James Bond.
And it was a new Bond, and Brosnan was Bond.
Secret agent is back.
We aim to please.
And this time, 007 is facing the ultimate enemy. The man who knows him best.
Hello, James.
What an unpleasant surprise.
Oh. 006.
I didn't know they gave away that in the trailer.
Oh, yeah.
He was your friend, and now he's your enemy, and you will kill him.
Is the satellite in range?
You think this is a good trailer, and then now you're like, all right, just give me a little bit more.
He's about to be caught in the crossfire.
Marissa, how far into the trailer are we here?
You first. Kill him.
The pleasure will be all mine.
Did you check her out? Head to toe.
Three clicks, arms the fuse.
Don't say it.
The writing's on the wall.
Grow up, 007.
I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War.
Yeah.
You know, James, I was always
so interesting, because they were completely aware of it.
Boys yes, with toys. Totally.
And like, that's a dame telling him that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think of it.
Charming, sophisticated.
It's the most honest
agent.
Moment of the entire
Chicken
movie.
Me, but not disturbing.
Get us out of here!
Bond. Only Bond. Man just won't take a hint.
Kill him!
Kill him!
I need the gun.
That depends on your definition of safe sex.
On November 17th.
Grab
him! United Artists brings you.
Just so long.
James Bond.
Really long trailer.
Why can't you just be a good boy and die?
That's one trick I've never learned.
Keeps going.
Everything. Like, all the things.
So that's sweet, because it reminds me of the video game
sick.
So much.
Yeah, it
the
does.
Music?
Yeah, the music and the title. Oh, that game was the greatest
it was.
Ever.
It's the greatest thing that's ever happened.
I think if you were a male between the ages of, like, what, 24 and 32, like... Yeah. You played that game incessantly.
Extensively.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question. All right, guys, so we're going to get into the show. The first thing we do on this show, if it's your first time watching or your first time listening, is we break something out called thesis statement. This is your bold statement, your biggest thought about the film. When somebody asks you about, have you watched Goldeneye recently? You're like, well, yeah, but here's the thing about that movie. You want them to listen, you want to hold court, and you're going to prove your point throughout the episode. I'm going to go first with this one.
Please.
And say, I had like five that I liked.
Oh,
I know
there's so many.
But I'm going to just say the one that, like, it made me laugh on the way here. The best part of any James Bond movie is Pierce Brosnan's hair in this movie.
You mean his helmet head?
Yeah, but it's not.
But it's like a perfect helmet.
But you're saying it's a helmet because it's an optical illusion.
It is.
Because when you think about his hair, when you imagine it, it seems like this mane, this incredible like shape, and it's so just... But then you look at it, and it's like just a normal-ass haircut. It's just, it doesn't do
there's
anything...
There's so much fluff and body
but
to
there's
it.
There's not!
Why does it look that way,
close
then?
To his head. I don't know. On the way here, I looked it up, and I was like... I've done this before, by the way. I've looked up the shape of Brosnan's hair many times.
And, this is what we do.
And I was like, all right, this must be a consensus. The world must all agree with me that he has the best hair. And I looked up James Bond best hair. And there was a bunch of articles like how to get James Bond's haircut, the Connery Classic, the Daniel. And I was like, you guys are crazy. Those are like normal heads of hair that like Ryan Reynolds or like Ryan Gosling would have in a movie. Nobody has Brosnan hair. Nobody. He just, in my mind, it's like, you know, in that in the Rick James sketch when Dave Chappelle's is like, he had an aura. I seen it. Like, that's the way I imagine Brosnan's head. It's like an aura of hair.
The chat is really enjoying how excited you are about this.
I felt that it was an important thesis to share. Moving on.
Connery didn't have a hair. It was a wig, they said.
Yeah, well, there you go.
There you go. That's a
great point.
Couldn't
even give him better hair with a wig.
Couldn't do it. Well, that is a very good thesis.
Thank you.
It's very, very poignant thought. mine is that this is the most generationally specific Bond there ever has been. And I think that for Brosnan in the 90s is the only time he could have succeeded the way that he did, to the level that he did, and yes, have the audiences receive him the way that we did. Going back and watching it now, it's borderline offensive, and it's not even cool. He's not even cool.
No.
Like 80% of his lines are one-liners, and you and I were talking. It's like he doesn't really do anything. He's kind of the definition of like the 90s everyday hero.
He's like basically British Schwarzenegger in Commando.
Yeah, or like British Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, but like cooler.
Yeah.
Like in the sense of like he doesn't do anything you and I couldn't do in this movie other than like drive a tank through a city that drifts. Yeah. But like I feel like that probably didn't really happen. not to say that I don't like it. I just think that like it was that perfect thing of like opportunity meets the right time. And it was like Brosnan being kind of a nobody in the early 90s and this movie happening was just like he looked the part. He sounded the part. He was cool. He was suave. He was sexy. He was funny. And like one thing I do really appreciate this is no matter how ridiculous the one-liners are, and like you and I, we get told to like read copies sometimes. Like we'll come in here and it's like, hey, you guys need to like read this thing
about this
company.
Yep.
And you're like
a live read.
Yeah, a live read. And you kind of are like, all right, let me get through this. And you say it and you're like, that sounds kind of, did that sound good? You know, does it sound fake? But what I will say is like Pierce Brosnan walks out of that helicopter after it's about to blow them up and he ejects and he's like, you know, he's like, I'll do anything to get freaking file miles these days. And you're just like, the way he says it is with such earnest conviction that, like, I remember, I'm like, wow. Like, I believe him in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, but, like,
That's how this guy talks.
Yeah. It's like, that would never work in any other time period.
Kind of like the same way we talk about, like, Denzel's, like, attitude. Like, if anybody in real life actually used the lines that he uses,
you'd like, in Training Day?
You'd be like, no. You'd just be like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, like, are we... I asked you a real question and you're not answering.
What does that even mean?
You're speaking in tongues? So I just think that like GoldenEye and Brosnan, it was just the most perfect thing that could happen to Bond in the 90s, even more so than Connery in the beginning and even more so than Craig now.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that you're saying that is super true is that every Bond is super era specific and that they, you know, they definitely change and they adapt and they evolve. And when we last year, I guess it was last year probably or the year before, we were going to do Spectre when Spectre came out, and we ended up doing Casino Royale instead because we saw Spectre in theaters and we really didn't like it.
Yeah, it was appalling.
Yeah, and what ended up happening was, it was like they had started to drift a little bit back towards the kind of campiness of old Bond movies. It's like they were still trying to do a lot of the serious stuff that they wanted to do in those Craig movies because they're a very, very different breed of movie. Mm-hmm. But there was that campiness, and I think each era. I mean, I would say that the Bond movies in general have favored that campiness over the years. You know, the first 25 years of Bond movies, that was like kind of the MO all through the 60s and 70s and the 80s. And so when you watch this one, it's sort of like this was the first time we had seen Brosnan. There hadn't been a Bond movie in 6 years, and they were trying to decide what to do with the guy. The two Timothy Dalton films had attempted to make those a little darker, not dark like the Daniel Craig movies, but they were a little more serious. And they were like, you know, we're going to make this a straight up 90s James Bond movie. And it was a huge success. This movie was very successful.
Totally. And the reason it was so successful. And again, we're not griping here. We're just calling it what it is.
This movie came out 22 years ago and we both saw it in theaters, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. And I bought the video game the day it came out. I begged my mom to take me to Walmart and buy it. And I played it with my best friend, Derek. And like, that was just how it was.
Yeah.
And like, we went through and played every level and we beat it in one day. And we talked about the movie and everything. And that's just the way life was. And, you know, Matt Movies here is saying that, you know, that's also what makes it fun. Totally, dude. Yeah. That is exactly why we still love GoldenEye and why we're covering it on the show. But it just has, it's just changed.
So before we get into Fist Bump Moment, I'd like to share a story here on the show. You're talking about the video game, and I think it's probably the appropriate moment. So I still have my Nintendo 64.
So do I.
And it's packed in a box in my storage. I just moved for the last time, third, fourth time since I moved here. And my good buddy, I think you've met before, Yuval.
He's
one of my oldest friends in the world. We played a lot of GoldenEye growing up. We played an extensive amount of GoldenEye. So much so that we played so much GoldenEye that this one summer when I was 19, he and I, I'm sorry, 2 years before that when I was 17, we decided that we were going to have a 10-round GoldenEye tournament. And it was going to be 10 levels. And not only that, we were going to sign a contract. We were going to write a contract out that said, if I win this tournament, you must refer to me from here to eternity as Master-in-Chief. No, Commander-in-Chief.
Yes.
And these are going to be the settings. We agreed on the settings. And so I beat him in the tournament when we were 17. I beat him outright. And he signed the contract.
Ball.
And he was like surprisingly cool about it. He was like, yeah, all right. Well, you know. It was a good match.
Oh my God.
Like,
I bet inside he was dying.
And I was like, yeah, he's taking it pretty well. I was like, all right, I'll be right back. And I go to the bathroom and I come back and he's nowhere to be found. The contract's gone. And I was like, where'd he go? And I run after him. He's gone upstairs and he's in the bathroom. He's torn the contract and I'm running towards him. He puts one piece in his mouth and one in the toilet and he flushes the toilet and he refuses to open his mouth, eats the half the contract, flushes the other half down the toilet. And immediately refuses to admit that it happened. Just denies its existence.
And this is something that... Okay, all right.
2 years
I'm
later...
I'm very excited.
In the house that we were living, and we lived in the same house just one summer, he goads me into doing another one. But this time there's an audience of 10 people. It's all of who we live with and our friends. Another contract. Same thing. And I'm so angry and so convinced that I'll beat him.
Right.
He beats me with throwing knives as the final level. And I have to accept the loss.
Oh, that's painful.
In front of all of our friends. It took him 7 years before he admitted to our friends that he had destroyed the first contract.
That was only 2 years ago.
No, we were 19 in that. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just our last year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It took like a wedding that we all went to from high school where he was drunk enough to finally like admit that it had happened.
I gotta say that I ate the contract.
What? Yeah. Anyway, that was my story, guys.
Amazing. That is absolutely
amazing.
The look
of just like total just like terror on his face as I'm just barreling towards him as he's eating the contract.
How did you feel when you lost, man? That must have been like excruciating.
It was like we like don't compete in things anymore because the few times we've done it, it's just gotten more and more heated. It's just like legitimate rift in friendships when I would lose or he would lose at something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I absolutely know exactly what you're talking about. I think that's basically my fist bump for the day.
So anyway, let's move on to the next part of the show. Guys, fist bump moment is that moment when you're watching the film, something happens, you kind of look around, you're like, are you seeing this right now? Are you watching this? This is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
You're working on something? Perfect. Put it down, look at the TV right now, 5 minutes. This I need to take for 5 minutes.
This is what's so great. Yeah. And sometimes they're like, the people will be like, I don't understand what's okay. You're like, but it's great to me.
Yeah.
And that's why it makes me feel.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, actually, you know what? One just popped up in the chat right away, so we might as well just read it, right? Richard Eric Jarvie. Oh, what's up, Jarvie? When the Russian general takes way too many sips of vodka from his flask during the tank chase, which is so funny because I called Ben this morning, or we were on the phone this morning and talking. I was like, what about General Orlov just like chugging vodka, being like, take a left, take a right? You know, like it was hilarious to me. So what is your fist pump?
Oh, my fist bump moment through and through is the first moment that we see Brosnan drifting in a tank. It was like, okay, so you guys expect me to believe, first of all, that there's a sports car. There's like a classy looking like Aston Martin style sports car. And there's a tank that Brosnan's commandeered, mind you. He knows how to drive a tank.
Probably all the instructions and manuals are in Russian, most likely.
Now, Brosnan is standing outside of the tank. He's not standing in the tank in a safe place.
Because we know that the whole point of tanks, not to be safe, is so that you can see the driver while he's driving.
And Brosnan is driving the tank with such vigor, he's able to chase down a car through city streets.
And adjust his tie.
And on top of that, pull basically e-brake maneuvers in a tank, going so fast in something that probably weighs like a fucking metric ton.
Yeah, they based Tokyo Drift off of this scene.
He can like swing the tank around, and then finally, just before he adjusts his tie, you realize he's plowed through like, I don't know, 12 or 15 buildings, standing outside the tank with nothing ever falling on him, messing up his hair,
no dirt on his suit,
nothing. And that has to be my fist pump moment in this movie. Just through and through. I was like so pleased.
It's because it's perfect. It's perfect.
Tank drifting.
You know what, it's so funny because you keep having like very They just seem to correlate better to the seriousness of this film with your fist pump and your thesis. And like mine are like, I'm like, it feels like I'm talking about like The Godfather with mine or something. You know what I mean? So my fist pump is actually the reveal of Sean Bean as the villain.
It's rebellion.
I just, like, yeah. I think it's the best scene in the movie, and I'm shocked at the trailer, because I haven't watched the trailer in, like you said, 22 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that they revealed that he was the villain, but, like, and we're going to get into this, because you said we're going to do Over, Under, and Properly Siege with Sean Bean.
Yep.
He's the best part of this movie by a mile, and he's so good, and, like, I love that scene, because you see... You see exactly what everyone else saw. You see exactly what all the producers saw in Sean Bean then. And you're like, this guy's got something.
Oh, yeah.
And he could be really good at... This guy should die in every movie he's ever been in. yeah, I don't know what it is, man. I think it was a fist pump to kind of just be like, wow, 22 years ago, Sean Bean was still kind of doing the same thing as he is now.
Yeah.
Almost he's doing... It's like he's almost regressed, even though he's still working. Like, he's still working so much. But this is like... He is the villain in a Bond movie.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing.
Huge. I mean, that's Christoph Waltz. That's Javier Bardem.
These are Academy Award winning people you're talking about here.
Yeah, these are like big time.
Yeah.
Mads Mikkelsen. I mean, these are the actors that are the villains of the biggest movies.
And they're incredible. And so for me, it was that moment of just like seeing Bean, and I think it is because you talk about it, I'm an actor, and I look at him and I'm like, not only is he great in this movie and he's so committed, but like, damn, dude, good for you. It's 22 years later and you're doing the same thing back then as you are right now. So like, I love it. I love Sean Bean. I love this scene, and yeah, that's my fist bump.
Let's get into the next part of the show here, because I think it will lead us into kind of the what we want to talk about with the show. So star profiles.
Yeah.
Let's start out here with Brosnan, because I think it's important to talk about where he was in his career. So I don't know if you know the story or the history behind Brosnan's foray into Bond. It's a pretty interesting story, actually, and it was told to me originally last week by Jason Smith of Fox Sports, who I work with on Sundays, and who's guest on the show. And we were talking about Brosnan, because 2 weeks ago we did The Foreigner, and I told him my thesis in that movie was the worst thing to ever happen to Brosnan's career was James Bond.
Oh, yeah, which I actually think is an excellent thesis.
Yeah.
And what did he say to that?
He said, well, you know, it's because he was Bond at the wrong time. And I said, what do you mean? We said, well, you know the story, right? I go, no. And he goes, okay, so Brosnan rose to fame in the 80s with a show called Remington Steele.
Yeah.
And it's a show, if anybody doesn't know, it's basically a romantic detective show. He's got a romantic tension with this woman who runs the detective agency, and he is the guy he's like the face of Remington Steele. It's a fictional character, and he plays that fictional character for her agency.
Got it. It
ran for years, it was very successful, and, I mean, for a TV show. And in the late 80s, there was a report that the next James Bond would be Pierce Brosnan. The producers offered the role to Brosnan in 1987, before Dalton did Living Daylights. And Brosnan accepted. But then the ratings improved.
Oh my God.
On Remington Steele.
Right.
And they said they were going to do another season, and they wouldn't let him out of his contract. And so Brosnan, they revoked the offer, and Timothy Dalton got the job. And this was in 87. So Dalton and Brosnan were friends, and they both had done things. Like, one of them was in like a Coke commercial, the other was like, you know, billboards. They both kind of had the James Bond look. Dalton did it for 2 years. There was contract disputes with the producers. They never made the third film.
Yeah, Dalton just was in two.
He was
right?
in two. Yeah. He was supposed to make a third film in 91, but he didn't. He was in Living Daylights and License to Kill. And they were reasonably successful. People liked him as James Bond. They didn't love him.
A lot of people, I actually know a handful of people that think Dalton was the best Bond.
Yeah, people like
him. Which is really interesting, yeah.
And then 6 years later comes out Goldeneye. And at that point, you know, now Brosnan's almost a decade older than he was the first time they offer, which is interesting because here in this movie, he's good, but he does look... He is just slightly older than I think you'd want your Bond to be in the first Bond movie you see.
Totally. Like, I believe Daniel Craig in the beginning of Casino Royale.
Yes.
Whereas, like, if you put Brosnan in the beginning of Casino Royale, I would not believe that. Does that make sense?
Totally. He doesn't feel like the sort of, like, young, hungry, athletic... qualified Bond that I think you would imagine, but it's also a different era. So that's the story of Brosnan and sort of what happened with his career and how he ended up as Bond in the mid 90s and why he is older when he gets the role. You have to think that if he had been Bond in 87 following Roger Moore, he really might have had a more successful Bond career, and not even a Bond career, that I think he would have had a more successful movie career. By the time he was done playing James Bond, he was a guy who was almost 50, I think.
Right. And it was like, you know, Kearns here was talking in the chat about how, you know, when you play Bond, you can't even wear a tux for anything else.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy. Like, that's a small thing. You know, how often do you really wear a tux? But you think about it, as a production company, it's like, do I even want to touch the guy that has, like, these type of things in his contract?
Totally.
I don't, because it's a pain in the ass. And also, maybe he's a diva now that he's James Bond. And so, it is really interesting that, like, yeah, man. I mean, and I think that's a great thesis, and you could have used it again today.
Totally.
And you look at Pierce Brosnan's career, And it took almost 20 years after the Bond franchise ending for him to kind of pop up in another movie role that was like, and even The Foreigner was kind of a small movie. You know, it's like totally. Kind of an indie, small release, like...
Completely. And I, his career, by and large, unless he is able to find a franchise or some other thing that he becomes a part of that's like a big deal, his career is in the twilight of it. He's in character actor who could be in the movie and gets the Oscar nom kind of territory, but not the guy that... He's not going to be in an action or a spy franchise, probably. Yeah.
And it is interesting because, like, I know that people have, and Jake Shields called reference to this, saying that, like, you know, some people said that Daniel Craig was a little old looking in the first Bond. And I think actually what it was not old looking, but when he was cast, it was the literal age of him was the oldest Bond that had been cast, yeah. Maybe. But the thing is that, like, we're getting towards an era now where men and women are doing things that they couldn't do 10 years later, whether it's having children or whether it's like competing in athletic events,
yeah.
Whatever it might be, is like science and has evolved to the point to where we can do things past when we used to be able to do them.
Oh, and I think like athletic training and nutrition. I mean, you look at like the way that
recovery
Craig,
and
I mean, you look the way that Daniel Craig looks in Skyfall, even.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like still like shredded. The guy is like in insane shape.
Right.
And he's got to be, he's at that point, he's got to be close to what, late mid to late 40s?
Totally. Whereas if you took off bras and shirt, I think in any Bond film, which I think it happens in one of them,
in
it's like,
one, yeah.
Yeah, he's not shredded.
No.
He doesn't have a six pack
or
anything.
Guy, yeah.
He's, you know, it's kind of like that 90s body that we always talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the movies that Brosnan was doing at the time was he did Entangled in 1993, Mrs. Doubtfire, he was Stew in 1993, and The Love Affair in 1994.
And Lawnmower Man in 1992, which was like...
That was a big one.
That's like a big sci-fi cult classic. People love that movie. So yeah, I mean, that was... And Remington Steele had ended just a few years prior. So he definitely had been the guy on the TV show, and then the TV show kind of, you know, it ended, and he didn't immediately have something to jump into that was big. His career in a lot of ways did falter for the next about 7 years.
Yeah, and in between this time of 92 and 95, he did about a TV movie or two every single year in between. And that was kind of what you did back then. It's really interesting, if like as an up-and-coming actor, because you go to the other side and you look at Sean Bean did Black Beauty in 1994 and Shopping in 1994, but he was also part of this Sharps trilogy, which looks like it's like an American Civil War, Revolutionary War. I don't really know. And like, if I'm misspeaking, please correct me in the chat or something. But it's like one of those, like, it looks like a war trilogy, like
sure.
TV movie type thing. And he starred in those, and he was sharp in all of those. So, like, these guys were both on their way up, and they were both doing exactly what you were supposed to do in the early to mid-90s as a leading man.
Yeah.
But that gets us in the conversation of Sean Bean. And, like, this guy's career, because my thesis was literally saying that I applaud the guy for doing something 22 years ago that he's doing now.
Yeah.
But also, you look at that and it's like, does that mean that he hasn't really moved forward? He hasn't made any progress, which I don't think that.
Well, I think we should probably play Overly Sieged, Underly Sieged, Properly Sieged about Sean Bean here.
Yeah.
Big shout to, again, I wish I had in front of me who came up, who coined that term. Was it Kearns?
I think it was Paul. It might have been Paul Oyama.
Okay.
It might have been him.
You're probably watching or listening, as, you know, if you're going to suggest the theme of a... of the name of a segment. So credit to you on Overly Sieged, Underly Sieged, Properly Sieged.
Genius.
It's a great segment title. So I thought about this a lot with Sean Bean, trying to decide where do I think he lies. The first answer is that there's no way that Sean Bean is
under or overrated.
None in my mind.
It would be almost appalling to say that,
because I don't think that, even though like the size of several of the roles and the parts that he's had are these beloved cult characters, doesn't matter. He's really great in everything he's in, so he can't be overrated. So the question just becomes to me, is he underrated or is he properly rated? And I have to say, I actually think Sean Bean is underrated. That would be my answer. So I think Sean Bean is under siege.
I completely agree, man. I think Sean Bean is under siege. The only reason that I want to say that he is not and that he's properly rated is because I would worry that if he got more credit, he wouldn't play Boromir.
Yeah.
He wouldn't play
Yannis.
He wouldn't play he wouldn't be in Game of Thrones. So like, I want to say properly sieged, because despite how much I love Bean and despite how incredible I think he is, he's kind of like a William H. Macy, is where I don't really want to see you surpass the point you're at, because you are one of the greatest at what you do.
For me, the reason I say under sieged is like, Bean is the most, he is my favorite character in the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy.
And his moment is your favorite moment in the entire trilogy.
He's great. That whole first film, he's just, he plays the villain, but you understand his pain so much.
Yeah.
He's so memorable in Ronin. He's so great in Ronin.
Yeah. And he's only in it for a small bit.
He's just such a good character. Mm-hmm. He's the part that I remember watching as a kid. He's so great as Ned Stark. That's the thing, is like Game of Thrones, when, you know, big spoiler alert, if you haven't watched Game of Thrones, you know, he dies at the end of season one, and it's shocking. And I was so disappointed. When I watch that show still today, now,
I miss him.
Yes, he was my favorite character.
Really?
And he's because he's Sean Bean. He's so great. Like, I just want him in the show. So, and then obviously Trevelyan, you know, 006.
Yeah, loved him as 006.
And yeah, and aside from that, he doesn't have a lot of big headlining roles. Those are, I think, probably his four most notable. Ronan to me, but probably not to most of the world.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's two others that pop up that are pretty major. He had a show based around him a few years ago, I remember. I can't remember like what it was. It was called like,
oh, I know what you're talking about.
Sean Bean had a show. He like on like NBC or something.
But that's like that's the definition of why he shouldn't get those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Sean Bean, and it's interesting because I think most people are kind of saying he's underrated, because I do really feel that way.
Yeah.
And the only reason I say he's not is because it's for selfish reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think we can be in agreement on that. Guys, let us know what you think about it. Let us know in the chat or online at AMA Podcast or in the fan group. And just really quickly, because Keys asked, who's the Bond girl in this movie? Keys Cornelius, thank you for the question. Is it Xenia or is it Natalia?
Well, okay, in retrospect, it's clearly Xenia, because obviously Famke Janssen. Sorry, yeah, Marissa.
Famke Janssen.
Big shout out to Marissa Serafini in the booth, who actually interviewed Famke. She did a sit-down interview. You can find that here on AfterBuzz somewhere, right, Marissa?
Yep. AfterBuzz TV under a spotlight on interview.
Yeah, and Marissa is the biggest fan of Famke that I've ever met, and she knows everything about her, everything that we need to know about her. We always ask her. So why not ask her this question instead of us answering it? Marissa, who is the true Bond girl in this movie? Is it Natalia, who is basically the damsel in distress, or is it Xenia, who is the villain?
I think it's Xenia. I don't want to sound biased, but I think Xenia had more memorable moments in this
movie. For sure.
Absolutely.
More, if you isolate her scenes, she has more moments that are that people talk about. You don't really remember the main character.
No, you don't remember Natalia at all.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's so crazy. Lenore. Listen, Lenore. What's so crazy to me is that this is one of those great examples of someone completely disappearing in a role and then me not noticing it over like 10 years that she was this person. You know what I mean?
Forgot?
Yeah, because you're like a kid and you don't really realize. That's like, you know, who Famke Janssen is as a kid. She's nobody.
It's funny she's playing a Russian character in this movie.
Yeah.
It's just like...
But anyway, I love it. I think, I totally agree. I think Xenia is the badass Bond girl, which also, I was terrified to have sex for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. Because of this. I have like such distinct memories of this movie girl.
Xenia!
Yeah.
I can't
that guy?
Breathe!
And the way his face looks when he comes out of the closet. It's
horrifying,
yeah, totally.
As a kid.
It's so funny.
Yeah, and it's the things that are so like silly now, but like back then were terrifying.
Seared into your memory. I think we're kind of in agreement there.
Yeah.
Let's continue moving on through the episode. So.
Yeah, so I don't really want to talk about writing a lot, because what I think is so interesting about this, Ian Fleming is the guy that created James Bond and all the characters, but Jeffrey Crane and Bruce Feirstein were the ones that actually wrote the screenplay and the script, and this was the very first time in any Bond movie where they didn't pull from Ian Fleming's source material, which, again, it just seems perfectly fitting because it was the 90s, and that's what you would do in the 90s.
Totally.
You're like, I'm going to take James Bond and do this with him because he's just that thing, and then everyone would be like, yeah,
right.
You know, and so I think it was perfect, and like, I think that, you know, the return back to Ian Fleming's writing was important, but also at the same time, I also think in the 90s with every Brosnan film, you could have just had like Shane Black write them.
Yeah,
it would have been better.
Oh, for sure. I mean, these movies are like they're pretty empty. I should be very clear with everyone, and I think I've said it a number of times.
Kern said he showed this movie to his 14-year-old cousin, and he freaked out during that sex scene.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah,
I should probably point it out to everybody. I think I've said it once before, but I think Bond movies are bad movies by and large. I'm pretty convinced at this point. There's been how many, like 24 Bond movies? I think 24, 25, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I like just, I think that like 85% of them are bad. I think like there's like six good Bond movies, maybe five or six. There's like basically two good Daniel Craig movies. There's if you can consider, this isn't a good movie.
Like, yeah, but if you have to, you have to take one.
I don't know. I watched this movie again just last night and this morning, and like, if you were going to ask me if this is a good movie, this is not
a good movie.
So like, those two Daniel Craig ones are both good, solid. Skyfall's not as good as Casino, but I at least like it. I definitely like the Dalton movies. Like, I would need to go watch them again to review them to really be able to pass judgment.
Same. And same with the Moore movies. It's like, I've seen like 80, I think I've seen 75% of the Bond movies over the course of my life.
Me too.
But that's over the course of almost 30 years now. And like, I just don't have recollection of so many of them.
We talk to like movie critics, movie nerds. People will tell you that like several of the Connery movies are really good. The early ones, Goldfinger's a good movie. But overall, by and large, I think Bond movies are pretty bad. So it's not that, and it's not even like objectively bad. It's more like bad because we're smart as an audience now, and what we want out of a movie is so different that these movies, like this movie, was borderline offensive in how it
totally is. Like, I mean, and thank God we watched the trailer, because you know Judi Dench even says it. It's like, you're a sexist, misogynistic dinosaur.
Yeah,
and like the way that you act doesn't really work in this world anymore. But then they allowed him to do it for almost an entire decade.
I mean, that's what the audience of James Bond wanted. Like,
Of course.
We'll address a little more of this as we go, because like the level of sexism in this movie. And the amount of, like, the women just being portrayed as objects for Sean Connery to just, like, do what he pleased with was ridiculous. It was like...
Absolutely.
It was like scenes with him and Natalia where she'd be like...
Excuse me, Pierce Brosnan, not Sean Connery.
No.
Yeah,
no,
you said Sean Connery.
It would be scenes with, like, they get out of, like, the burning situation. They've had, like, basically no character relationship whatsoever. And she's like... okay, let's go have sex now. And you're like, all right, so I guess that's James Bond. And then later she's like, you don't care about anybody. You, like, you're so cold. Why are you so... Wait, I can't resist you. I want to have sex with you again on the beach.
Yeah, on the beach.
What?
Like, but you were so mad. And then earlier on, in the very beginning of the movie, the scene where they're, like, doing this car chase scene. And it's like, imagine if you were driving around with your girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And this hot woman drives up next to you in a Ferrari. And you're like, I'm just going to start racing her, honey. And she's like, but you're going to kill us.
She literally, she says to him, I enjoy a spirited car chase as much as the next girl. And she says, who's that? And he goes, the next girl. You're like, what?
The next girl? Like, what are you doing? So then he proceeds to get in this car chase that almost kills both of them. Then they spin out. She's freaking out the whole time. He is not to be bothered. And how is he bothered? How does he fix all this? He just stops the car, loosens his tie, and pushes a button. Because what comes when that button's pushed? Alcohol, because that's what you should be doing when you're driving, is drinking champagne and terrifying a woman and chasing another woman.
Yeah, it was outrageous.
Yeah, the 90s. Thank God for that.
Yeah. So, So we'll talk about some of this stuff a little more, but let's talk Martin Campbell for a minute. This is the second show in a row we've broken down Martin Campbell. What a fascinating director in the end, and I know this is sort of just repeating ourselves, but like, okay, The Mask of Zorro is sweet.
Yep.
And Casino Royale is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't he also do Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, didn't he also do something with Edge?
Well, he did Edge of Darkness, right?
Yeah, the one
with
Gibson.
I never watched. Did you ever watch that?
I didn't watch that.
That was like kind of his return movie,
totally.
If I recall.
And then he went and he did Green Lantern in 2011, which was kind of one of those things that made everyone that was a part of that franchise kind of disappear for a little while.
It was Rupert Wyatt that did the Planet of the Apes movie. I was wrong about
that.
Yeah,
that's right.
He's like a pretty fun director. Overall, Casino Royale, Legend of Zorro are both... Wait, The Legend of Zorro? No, he did The Mask of Zorro.
Yeah, I would love to... Yeah, it's right above it.
Yeah.
I would love to do The Mask of Zorro on the show. I really think we should.
Maybe.
Good. Just go watch it.
You love that movie.
I want to watch it right now.
It's one of your favorites.
It's so good.
And you love Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Oh, I love Catherine Zeta-Jones. My mom, if you ever say Catherine Zeta-Jones or Zorro, my mom will always talk about her and how she's the most beautiful woman she's ever seen in her whole life.
Movie.
In that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just without fail. It's like pushing a button and it's like pulling a pull string on Woody.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what will
happen. She's very beautiful. She had a really good run there. Traffic, I think it's within a year or two of that.
That
she's
movie is
gorgeous.
So good.
Traffic's great.
Yeah. But yeah, Martin Campbell's a great director. It's just one of those guys that he's kind of had that, one of those careers where it's really hard to decide whether or not he's a great director or not.
He likes to make action-packed movies. That's what he does.
Yeah.
That's the thing he's done his whole career. It actually makes me want to go watch Edge of Darkness, because I watched The Blood Father recently, and Mel Gibson.
You called me in the middle of it.
It was a true fist bump moment. And it was that movie, by the way, guys, if anybody hasn't seen The Blood Father, is absurd and awesome and hilarious and ridiculous, and older Gibson is very fun to watch, so I recommend it.
A lot of people are asking for Mask of Zorro in the chat, Ben.
I'll bet they
are. Hey, guys, if you want Mask of Zorro, tweet at me, at Ben Bateman Media, and just say how much you love Mask of Zorro.
Let's just go ahead and do three Martin Campbell movies in a row, just back to back to back.
Right. All right, so moving on to producers, Barbara Broccoli, Michael G. Wilson. I mean,
it Broccoli's produced every single movie. I mean, more than anything, we like to say Barbara Broccoli because it's a great name.
It's an awesome name. It's a great name.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really want to talk producers on this movie.
No, there's no point. But what we do want to talk about is critical and box office reception, because this is one of those things that just lets you know the times have changed. So this was produced by MGM. It cost $60 million to make. It was released in November of 1995. It grossed $106 million domestic for an additional $245 million worldwide, for a grand total of $352 million, which is basically multiplying its budget by six times. And it got $26 million its opening weekend at number one. It's got a 7.2 on IMDb. It is rated 78% by all critics, 67% by top, and 83% by audience.
And the 77th greatest film of all... Just
kidding. Yeah, and on IMDb's... Exactly. So it's one of those things where, like, no one's going and watching Goldeneye now and going and clicking on IMDb and being like, I got to rate this. You know, I got to change this. It's like they probably did it into maybe 2001 or two, and then no one has reviewed it since then. These numbers are outlandish.
83%?
83. Even a 7.2 on IMDb is crazy to me.
It's excellent. I think one thing...
Kern's just tweeted at you.
I think one thing that's really important to make note of here is that, like, we sound a little bit just like... we sound a little on our high horse about the nature of this movie, I think, because we like to cover smarter movies, and we cover stupid action movies too. Yeah. But I don't think either one of us expected, as we covered James Bond and we dove deeper into James Bond, that we would come across the realization that James Bond movies are just like really sexist and like not particularly intelligent.
Well, it's tough, man, because like we're 29 years old in 2017. And there's a lot of shit going on right now in the world.
Yeah,
a lot of horrible stuff going on, you know?
Go ahead.
And so my point is that, like, when things like this come up from old movies that we really like,
yeah,
and that we have a strong affection towards, and you go back and you watch it and you realize a lot of things in it maybe aren't that cool and maybe didn't age that well, you got to call attention to it. You can't just brush over it. That's the biggest problem.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
So that's going to lead us nicely into favorite line, because... the favorite line of mine is when James Bond encounters another woman in this film, Moneypenny. And
oh my God, I know exactly. Yeah, go
and
ahead.
And there's a moment when he's talking to her, and she says something to him to the effect of, well, James, that would qualify as sexual harassment. And he looks at her and he says, and what's the penalty for that? and I'm watching and I'm like, let me open Twitter real fast.
Yeah.
Getting fired, your name dragged through the mud, losing your career, and going to prison if enough women speak up, because that's the state of the world we're in. So when James Bond asks, what's the consequence for sexual harassment?
In the workplace.
It's like the worst thing that's ever... I was like watching, I was like, this is so uncomfortable.
Yeah, of course it is, because you're watching with your girlfriend.
I like looked over, I like glanced over at her, and I almost wanted to just say to her, I thought this was funny when I was 8. I don't anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think this is
like,
funny.
This is, yeah, totally. and I get it, so that's your favorite line. And mine is just because I've been saying this line for almost 20 years. It's called, who's strangling the cat? Who's strangling cat? And then he shoots at the penguin. I just love it because I've just said who's strangling the cat in a Russian accent almost my entire life. And
yeah.
I also love that Minnie Driver is the singer.
It's amazing.
She was paid $5,000 for that role
to sing
that. And it was just one of those moments. I think it was part of a nostalgic fist pump. And like hearing that line was just so good for me. But the other one, my favorite one, and I always say this to you.
Yeah.
And it was, it's not God that gave me this face, James. It was you.
Yeah, it's a good one.
The time was for 3 minutes instead of six. And then he says it again later on. He's like, I'll give you 6 minutes, the same six you gave me.
Yeah.
And he's like, we've got 3 minutes.
We've got 3 minutes.
She's like, but he said six. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Inside joke.
The watch laser, the belt.
You remember the watch laser in the game, right?
Course.
Like burning through the things.
That's what I was going to say. Is like every single moment, every scene, every backdrop, everything in this movie, I remembered far more from the video game than from the movie.
Totally.
All of them. Like every part of it, every like... Oh, wow, like the shape of that room, and there's a door to the left, I'm sure of it.
I mean, like, the other thesis that we wanted to say was that this is the best movie-to-video game adaptation ever.
Yeah.
And it's tough because, like, that's a very bold statement, but, like, going back for our lives, I really truly believe that in the sense of, like, everything from even the lines in the video game were pulled from the lines in the movie and vice versa. And like,
yeah, I don't know that any game has ever better reflected a movie. And what I mean by that is like, yes, the adaptation was perfect, but also this game was played so heavily that I really think that the legend and the mythos behind this game surpassed the film very significantly. Like,
yeah, absolutely. But then the thing is, you go back and you play the game and you're like, oh my God, these graphics are horrible. The controls are impossible. Yeah. Like, I can't aim.
I can like literally shoot like 2 feet to the left of that guy's head, and the pixelation of his hair going so far out to the side will catch the bullet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So there's a couple AMA questions out there, and one that I wanted to address was that what do you think is the best movie to watch if you've never seen a Bond movie ever? Do you think you go like classic? Do you go like old school Connery? Or do you go, you know, just to pay tribute? Or do you do Daniel Craig?
Well, I think probably it just depends who you're talking to. Because mm-hmm. I know, for instance, like William Bibbiani, who writes for Crave, is a friend of ours. He's talked to me before about Bond movies. Like, he has this real affection for the older Bond movies. Like, he loves Sean Connery, and he has good things to say about those movies. So I think some people feel like the spirit of James Bond is something that is closer to that British kind of campy spy movie thing. Mm-hmm. And that what we like in Casino Royale so much is not as much of a James Bond movie as it's just like a dark drama. And that's not necessarily what they want out of a Bond movie. So I think it depends who you ask, because if you watched Casino, which in my opinion would be my suggestion,
yeah,
you don't really have very many movies you can go to from there. You can go watch like the other Craig movies, only one of which is good, mm-hmm. and you can go back and watch some of the older ones and hope that the spirit of the characters translated, but they're just so different than the catalog. Like, I really think that Casino Royale stands alone as a different kind of movie.
Totally. And for me, even though I love Sean Connery's versions, those are the ones I grew up watching, and they don't feel as campy as a lot of like the Moore and other ones in between, especially not as campy as the Brosnan era. But I do believe that as an audience we evolve, and yeah. I think that's the same thing why you go and it's like, if I want someone to watch a Batman movie, I'd probably tell them to go watch Batman Begins or Dark Knight, yeah. as opposed to Batman and Batman Returns.
Yeah.
Not that I don't love Batman and Batman Returns. I think they're excellent movies, but yeah. as an audience, we've evolved and developed into this thing like, we kind of want something a little darker and a little yeah. more set in reality, and we don't really want kind of cheesy one-liners. We yeah. want like one-liners that kind of make you think a little bit.
Definitely.
And so while I think that you should go and watch old Connery ones, while yeah. I think you should definitely revisit GoldenEye, I think that it's probably best to start at Casino Royale to kind of get you warmed up.
Yeah.
For sure.
I would agree.
Who's your favorite Bond?
Daniel Craig.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
It's mine too.
Yeah.
By like a mile.
Brosnan's hair would be answer one. But Daniel Craig would be my actual favorite Bond.
Yeah. He's just awesome.
Yeah.
He's just so good. And he's like, he just looks badass too.
Yeah,
he's a good looking man.
One thing I loved about, I recently watched Skyfall again, so we had talked about it on the show a
yeah.
lot. And somebody had complained about my lack of love for it. And I was on an airplane last week coming back from somewhere. And I was like, I should watch Skyfall. It's free on America and I can watch it. I haven't seen it since it came out. And I liked it. I enjoyed it. But I think my single favorite thing about Skyfall is that after he gets shot at the beginning of the movie and he disappears, he's like living on this beach drinking.
Oh.
And for like 3 months he's drinking. He's like just like, you know, doing shots of the scorpion on his hand,
yeah.
recovering from a bullet in his shoulder. And I love at the end of it, after 3 months of doing this, he like has sex with some woman who's like, he doesn't, it's a Bond movie.
You're right.
And then he like looks in the mirror and he's still like shredded.
Shredded.
Just ripped.
You and I both know what happens when you start drinking incessantly and stop working out for even a week.
I was like, if I got shot and I couldn't move my arm, so I like pretty much couldn't do anything physical, and I went to hold up in a hotel room in Mexico and I drank an entire bottle of whiskey every day for 3 months, probably I'd be dead.
Maybe that's how you get in good shape.
And if I wasn't dead, I would like gain like
at least 30 pounds.
Like, yeah. It's like, he's like, but that was like my favorite thing is that was the exaggeration in a Daniel Craig Bond.
Yeah.
Whereas like Pierce Brosnan gets to drift a tank.
Hey man, you've never drifted a tank. You don't know how hard
it
is.
I really don't.
I think this is the perfect segue to get into categories.
Yes.
It's got to be.
There are three action movie categories. There is totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, and ridiculously legitimate. Totally legit movies are like The Fugitive and Lone Survivor. They're movies that are held together by drama. You don't really ever laugh unintentionally. They feel like real movies. Not that they're better. They just feel more legit. Totally Ridiculous movies like Demolition Man and Face Off Con Air. They're really silly. You pretty much laugh the entire time, and they're great.
You're the only reason that that movie makes sense.
Yeah. And last but not least, we have Ridiculously Legitimate, Legitimately Ridiculous. I guess it's just Ridiculously Legitimate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of right in the middle, where most of it holds together. It's pretty good, but you definitely laugh a few times here and there. There's some parts of it that are like, this is preposterous, but I'm going to suspend my disbelief and just like it. Predator, Point Break, movies like that.
I'm doing it, man. I'm doing it.
The middle category?
Totally legit. No, I'm doing it. I'm doing middle category. I know it's crazy, and I know that I'm going to have a lot of, like, a big battle to defend this, but, like, it just is for me. It's just the time and the era and Bean and Brosnan and, like, Fomka. It's like, it's all so absurd, but the fact that it's all so absurd makes it all seem less crazy. You know what I mean? Because it's all operating up here that it all seems like it's a little more chill.
Totally. It's totally ridiculous.
It's like you go to a rave and everyone's acting wild and you're like, this is kind of normal.
I guess. I mean, I just think it's a ridiculous movie.
I completely agree with you.
I found myself wanting to apologize to the person I was watching it with because she had never seen a Bond movie before multiple times throughout the movie. I like felt embarrassed to be watching it a bunch of different times. And we didn't even talk about the whole, like, when he hits Xenia in the back of the head to knock her out. And you're like, I don't even understand. So you didn't feel comfortable making the correct sound because it sounds like your hand's hitting a chair. It doesn't sound like anything. You also didn't show it, but you're comfortable having him hit her in the back of the head.
Oh, right, because it just shows him, like, his face.
It shows his hand move off screen, and there's like a, but not like a, what it would sound like, I think, if the bottom of a metal gun hit the back of someone's skull.
Yeah, definitely not, because we've heard what that sounds like a lot in film and TV
movies.
Now. Yeah.
And they, like, it's very clear they wanted to diffuse this moment. There was just moments like that I was like, this is just so distracting on so many levels. Like, couldn't you have just tied her up?
Yeah.
Or something?
And also, like, when she gets pulled down by the helicopter, the fact that her body is what stops the helicopter from, like, pulling away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They both kind of stop and fall down. She's kind of just like,
Right.
But that's why it's legitimate.
Anyway, guys, there's just one last thing to do on the show this week, and it's called The Pitch. All right, guys, we don't have a specific choice, but there's a couple things on our radar.
So many things that are coming out that it was really hard for us to decide.
Yeah, so a couple ideas. Avengers would be one, because you've got the new Thor movie coming out. That's just a classic. We could just choose one of those classic superhero movies. We could choose Iron Man. We don't want to do a Thor movie. We could choose... There's a lot of different ones we could choose. We could choose Mask of Zorro, because Kearns tweeted it. But yes. I am more interested in the other film Kearns has been talking about, which is Sudden Death.
I know. We almost just did Sudden Death today out of nowhere. And also, we were like, we probably should have done a Halloween movie.
Right.
But, I know, Sudden Death
Did you watch
sweet.
The trailer?
Of course I watched the trailer.
Because the trailer looks excellent.
It's awesome.
Yeah, definitely the fact that... what's his name? The villain.
Oh, Kearns, what's his name? You're in the chat.
He's the guy from MacGruber. Powers Booth.
Powers Booth, yeah. I kept wanting to call him, anyway.
Yeah. Powers Booth is in there, and the movie just generally looks totally sweet, so I think we should watch that and see about that. But we're going to choose a movie. If you guys follow along on Twitter, at AMA Podcast, you go join the Facebook fan page, which there's, like, you know, grand people now for to talk about. We'll put up a poll, and we'll get your guys' opinions, and we'll choose a great movie. We'll announce it by the middle of the weekend, so you guys can get on top of it, watch the movie you should watch for the show. As always, thanks for watching, thanks for listening. You can find me personally at Ben Bateman Media.
You guys can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter, and look for us at AMA Podcast and find those fan groups on Facebook.
Yep. Talk to you guys soon.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.